Welcome to HackerRank Radio, Episode 2. I'm Vivek, one of the co-founders and CEO of HackerRank. Today, we have a special guest, Jawahar Malhotra, who has scaled engineering teams at various companies, starting from Netscape, Yahoo, IBM, and currently at HackerRank, which is also where I work. Welcome, Jawahar.
Thank you, Vivek. Good morning. Good morning to all of you.
Today, we launched a survey to our community to understand the developer persona and various dimensions of developers, right? From when did you learn to code to what are the three things that you look for before you accept a job offer? We got close to 40,000 developers responding to our survey and have some really interesting insights to share with all of you. You can download this report at research.hackerrank.com. But today, we're going to discuss some of the key insights from this report. Okay, are you ready, Jawahar?
I am ready. Let's go for it.
Okay, maybe before I wanted to do the intro of you, but I figured it'd be best if you give a quick intro and background about yourself, and then
sure.
We can get started.
Sure. So I've been at HackerRank for about 6-7 months. Prior to that, I was VP of engineering at a number of companies, OpenGov here in Redwood City. Prior to that, I was at IBM and Tea Leaf. And before that, I spent about 7 years at Yahoo. In the mid-90s, I was at Netscape as an engineer building some of the technologies for the web, mostly on the server side.
Okay. Now, this is a question that we ask all our guests in the podcast, and it's very interesting when we launched our survey to find this out as well, that 1 in 4 developers started to code before they could drive. And I'm curious to know, when did you start to code? And do you remember what's the first application that you built?
So I grew up in Optu High School in India. So the first application, this was at a time when we did not have personal computers. So the first thing I actually did was in Fortran, and it was without actually a real computer. It was really studying a book and trying to write some numerical computational algorithm. I then subsequently went to New York, and when I was in undergrad, I wrote my first program in Pascal.
And do you remember what it was? Was it a calculator? Was it a hangman?
Actually, the first main thing I did was there's this LaTeX and Tech, which is this language for typesetting. Yeah. And so I built a graphical tool for people to create diagrams, and then it would emit LaTeX and Tech code.
Oh, wow.
So it was a code generator.
Yeah. We still use LaTeX for our problem statements.
I love LaTeX.
Yeah. Do you still remember the Pascal and Fortran code?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. Moving on, there are, you know, we've got a lot of different insights. And one of the things that you're starting to see is the JavaScript frameworks are just growing like crazy over the last 4 or 5 years. And when I was in college, maybe 7 years back, I was still coding in native JavaScript. And maybe there was jQuery, which allowed you to manipulate DOM elements easily.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But off late, just in the last 3 or 4 years, there's Angular, React, Backbone. There's just a flurry of JavaScript frameworks. Mm-hmm. Do you think something happened, or have you been seeing this pattern for a long time? Also, I just wanted to clarify a rumor that you built JavaScript when you were at Netscape.
Okay.
So if you could walk us through the evolution of that.
Let me take care of the rumor first.
Okay.
So I did. I did not build JavaScript from scratch. I had the good fortune of working with Brendan Eich, who is actually the inventor of JavaScript. And the story, I'll make it very quick, was Brendan was busy working on a browser manipulation language. Those were the days, 1996, of static web pages. And so he was trying to, you know, give some control in the browser so you can manipulate what came down from the server and make the browser a little bit more interactive. Because we had just shifted from like heavy, rich desktop apps to a browser that was like almost frozen, right? Mm-hmm. So as he was doing that, we were working on server-side technology. And server-side was also CGI-based. There was no server-side scripting. And so we kind of brought those together and said, can we take what Brendan's doing on the browser, bring it into the Netscape web server? So I took on that task and worked closely with Brendan for about 9 months. The big challenge was what he had written was single-threaded, because the browser was single-threaded. Our server was multi-threaded. And so I had to spend 9 months pulling my teeth out, my hair out, trying to fix all the race conditions as I made the JavaScript engine multi-threaded.
Yeah.
Plus, we put a bunch of enhancements into it, so database access and stuff. So our first server-side scripting was you could actually render a page with data from a database.
Interesting. Right. And did you think that this language will actually take this kind of a shape over the next 10, 15 years? Did you imagine that to happen?
No, we did not. Because the other interesting bit was we were in close partnership with Sun Microsystems. So Netscape and Sun worked very closely together because we used a lot of Sun hardware.
Yeah.
And so Sun was busy creating Java.
Yeah.
And the whole vision was Java applets would be the thing that would run on the desktop inside the browser. And so JavaScript was the side thing, right? And history says that that was completely wrong.
Yeah.
Java applets never really took off. JavaScript became the main powerful language to manipulate the interface in the browser.
Wait, is that how JavaScript, the name?
Yes, the name also came because of that.
Oh, yes. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
So we actually aligned our launches, and we were calling our stuff LiveScript, and Java was coming out. So we aligned everything, and we said, okay, we'll call this JavaScript, and you guys call that Java. And
Okay.
And JavaScript was the language to manipulate the applet in the browser.
It
was the periphery of the applet.
But
instead, it kicked the applet out and became the main thing.
Yeah, I remember learning Java applets, and there were no websites that were doing Java applets, so it was pretty much didn't go anywhere. But then coming back to this, why do you think there's this sudden increase in the number of frameworks, or there seems to be a sudden buzz about JavaScript as a language and framework over the last 4 years? Or is it just me who's seeing it?
Yeah. So I have to tell you a little story before I answer that question. I think it leads to the answer. I just met one of my professors from 30 years ago for lunch, like 3 weeks ago. And I told him this story about JavaScript, and he actually said, and you know, back then I used to work on Lambda calculus and programming languages, which is the foundation for JavaScript.
Yeah.
And he was like, you guys really screwed it up. Because JavaScript, in some ways, it's becoming better over time, but it really took what's very pure, Lambda calculus, which is a pure mathematical thing, and made it very loose. And it's not pure functional. It's got lots of imperative things going on, state. And it's manipulating the DOM. It's kind of a lot of crazy stuff going on there. So it's not good purist computer science stuff. But I think because of that and the big need for people to build user interfaces, because the web, I think, has brought a lot of consumer, you know, has brought computing at the in the hands of everyone. And mobile has just accelerated that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so much need for front-end work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the people who work on front end, they generally, it's constantly changing, you know, the interfaces and the UI, UX. And so the environments need to continuously evolve to keep up with that change. Right. And if you contrast that with back end doesn't change that much.
Yeah.
It's much slower. Right. And so JavaScript has become the language, and then everyone is looking for structure so that you can create maintainable apps. You can create apps with less code because, you know, when you started, you had to write lots of code. And today you can write a little bit, like React makes everything reusable, componentized. So there's that constant quest for keeping up with the new hardware and the front end capabilities, but also to put more structure and put more frameworks. And so every framework comes up with some approach, and then someone else comes up with, well, that's bad there, and I'm going to do it a little better, right?
Yeah.
So this is proliferation of this happening in the marketplace, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting because, you know, one of the things that developers mentioned in our survey was one thing that they cared a lot about when they work in a company is the rate at which they can learn new things, right? And the rate at which new frameworks are coming, people are abstracting out different layers and making it easier for people to build things on top of it.
That's right.
And do you sort of resonate with this notion of one of the important things for developers when they work in companies is how fast they grow or how fast they learn?
I think it's a really important thing. I think developer happiness is equal to how much they're learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a function of how many interesting, challenging problems that we as leaders are presenting to them, right? If they're in an environment where they're getting harder and harder problems and they can feel like they're cracking more and more hard things, they're going to be really happy and you're going to have very high retention. So it's very true. Mm-hmm. Developers love to continuously grow their, you know, their knowledge.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the trends that, again, we looked at in the survey was how people move from one framework to another. And, you know, I've been a developer. It's been a while since I coded. But there is this constant pursuit of, oh, there is this new shiny thing. Let's actually go ahead and build this one on top of that. Let's actually change our infrastructure. How do you balance learning new technologies? Because you can't constantly keep changing whenever a new thing comes up. But also developers love to learn new things, but you can't constantly change things on production. How do you balance that when you're building out an engineering team?
Yeah, so I've seen this phenomenon multiple times and I've had to control it. I think it happens a lot more with front-end teams than it happens with back-end teams.
Yeah.
So I had this situation like a few years ago where the front-end team, which were amazing people, but they kept changing the storage and state management in the front-end. So, for example, went from Flummox, Redux to GraphQL to like, you know, just kept going on and on and on.
Yeah.
And so what I had to do was put some process and structure in place where before they could add anything new into our stack, they actually had to go through some approval and architectural design review and approval before adding anything new. There was a little bit of resistance, but I think people eventually got the point that it's okay to prototype new things, but it's not okay to keep adding new libraries into the production code because that can get you into lots of trouble down the road.
Yeah.
So putting some process around it, kind of finding that balance, right?
Yeah. Between developer happiness, like you mentioned, and ability to do it.
Right.
And I mean, given this is going to be the trend for quite some time, I mean, there's going to be some new framework, some new thing that's going to keep popping up. How do you evaluate this sort of trait for you to get accustomed to new environments as a developer during the interview process? What do you look for? Because you could verify the proficiency of somebody on React.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know for sure that this person will actually be able to get accustomed to a new framework that's going to come tomorrow during the interview process? What is the foundation or what do you look for when you're interviewing these candidates? Mm-hmm.
So let's take React as an example, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of concepts that are built into React, the way it manipulates the DOM. You know, is it MVC? What aspects of MVC does it use? How does it do state management?
Mm-hmm.
What is pure functional state manipulation? By probing into those deeper things that go above, beneath the veneer of React, you kind of get that understanding from them. Do they really understand, you know, what's really going on behind the scenes? Do they understand how a browser DOM gets manipulated? What is DOM differencing? You know, what are all these concepts and technologies behind it? If we are confident that they understand all of that, then we are confident that they can actually move to another framework should a new one show up.
Yeah, one of the things that we found was, which is really interesting, is almost all employers prioritize problem-solving skills first in the interview process. Almost, you know, people call this different things, problem-solving, computational thinking, breaking down a large problem into sub-problems.
Yeah.
How much importance or weightage do you give when you're interviewing a candidate for knowing a particular framework versus actually understanding problem-solving skills?
I'd say problem-solving is probably 10x over knowing a framework.
Interesting.
And I've also been interviewing a bunch of other execs like myself, heads of engineering, and that's very consistent. They all kind of echo that it's really important for the person to be able to solve problems. And they don't have to specifically know the framework that we are using. They could use some, they could know something else. But the fact that they can solve problems and they can think computationally, they can decompose problems, means that they will be able to learn something new quickly. I'd say problem solving and quick learning, both of those are really important.
Yeah.
If you have that combination, you can pretty much pick up anything. Right.
Yeah. And given the sort of spread of internet, and when we did the survey, we asked different questions about their background and persona. And one of the interesting thing was 74%, over 74% of people, even though they had computer science degrees or some sort of STEM degree, they were self-taught in terms of programming. There is a huge shift in the way people learn to code, how people adopt. And also the boot camps and others are also sort of pushing this trend of you can learn to code anywhere. You don't necessarily need a computer science degree for you to learn how to code. And what I've noticed or seen is most of these online courses or things that you learn focus a lot on this, okay, learn React in 10 days, learn
That's
Angular
right.
in 10 days, and
That's
learn
right.
this particular framework in 10 days,
That's
and
right.
not focus a lot on problem-solving skills.
That's
versus
right.
there's some sort of a disconnect in terms of, hey, what are you learning in all these self-taught or boot camps and others, which is what do you look for in an interview? What would be your advice for self-taught developers who are just going to learn on their own on how do you balance of understanding the core underneath components of it versus just knowing the framework or language?
I think everything you said is true. That's been my experience too. There's a lot of online video-based YouTube, Udemy, Udacity. I think the reason why a lot of that comes up is because it's become so much easier for a person who knows React to record like 30 video lessons, mm-hmm. which are very tactical. They are more about, okay, this is how you do step A, step B, step C, and you can get an app built at the end of it. And it's very gratifying, very fulfilling, and they can create a course out of it. And then, you know, a million people can watch that and actually get the same result. Mm-hmm. So it's great. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of that happening. And it's a good thing that people can actually get to that point very quickly. But if that's all they do, and I've seen this happen with React, I've myself done some of these courses with Spark. Mm-hmm. With creating a book, it takes a lot longer to actually, you know, get a book organized.
Yeah.
And there you have to really go deeper into a lot of material.
Yeah.
So videos and online courses are great because they cover on the surface. Now, if a person who's taking these courses, for example, like myself, I already have a computer science foundation, it's okay because I'm only building on that foundation. If you don't have that foundation and you're just doing these classes, my recommendation would be to find opportunities, whether it be maybe, you know, like take some classes at a slower pace at maybe a university or an online class, like, you know, not the superficial one, but more deeper classes mm-hmm. for the foundational pieces that go beneath what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So really go understand HTTP at a deeper level, mm-hmm. go understand caching at a deeper level if you want to be a really good front-end developer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in line with that, yeah, this is probably a trend that's going to be there for a very long time, probably for the decade or more. And I'm just curious, as a hiring manager, how much importance or weightage do you give to a traditional computer science degree? For example, if I'm going to interview with you and I don't have a STEM degree or even a computer science degree, but I have good understanding of problem-solving skills and a particular framework, or I've built some certain things, am I on equal footing with versus somebody who has a foundational CS degree for 4 years?
Yes, you are on equal footing. So the computer science degree is important, mm-hmm. but if somebody doesn't have it, but they can demonstrate to me that they have a lot of the skills that are needed at the level of depth, the degree is a non-issue completely, mm-hmm. okay, without any doubt. Mm-hmm. The challenge we face is, you know, it's very hard for developers who don't have the degree to gain visibility with someone like me. Right? Mm-hmm. It's very hard for them.
Yeah.
And that's why I think HackerRank actually is, you know, creating a platform for that to happen, mm-hmm. right? For developers to actually be able to surface themselves and showcase. Now, GitHub has actually done that somewhat successfully, and I've actually hired people, excellent people, through that mechanism, mm-hmm. people who've contributed to open source and brought those people. In fact, it was in the context of React. Mm-hmm. And I had an engineer we hired. He was really successful, and he moved on actually to the Facebook core React team.
Moving back, you've managed and grown engineering teams for the last 25 years, from Netscape to Yahoo at IBM and now at HackerRank. What have you seen change in what developers want? One of the things that we observed from the survey was, which was a little surprising to me at least, was the biggest thing the developers wanted when they moved to Java was work-life balance. Uh-huh. Well, of course, work-life balance is important. I don't deny that. I didn't expect that to be one of the top three or the most important thing. I'm curious to know, have things changed over the last 20 years of what developers want when they look for new jobs?
Yeah. I mean, I was just traveling over the holidays, and at multiple airports, I saw huge billboards of AWS.
Yeah.
You probably have seen them too.
Yeah, they're going crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that is a complete sea change over 20, 25 years ago, where developing or writing code or being a software engineer was this very niche thing, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's very mainstream. Every person on the planet is touching technology every day, multiple times, right? Internet of things, your mobile phones, your cars, your medical devices, everywhere. And everywhere, developers are key. Right?
Yeah.
That's a big difference. And so because of that, and because of the shortage of developers, the whole group of developers have become very powerful. And so
the salaries are also pretty high.
And I think that's consistent across the world. But so they've become very, you know, powerful. They're empowered to demand more things. In some ways, back 25 years ago, they were kind of in the back office.
Yeah.
Now they're in the front office, right? And so that's a big change that I think that's happened. Right?
And what about work-life balance? Do you think that has stayed, like 25 years back or 20 years back when you were at Netscape or Yahoo, was that one of the top considerations for developers before they joined the company, and how has it changed now? Or has it been consistent?
Those were startups. Netscape was a startup. It was always a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's life.
Yeah.
And that's been the case in Silicon Valley consistently. I think I'm hearing this now recently where developers feel empowered enough to demand. But even though they do, like most of my teams, even in the last 10 years, people work really hard. I think they enjoy working. They enjoy building.
Yeah.
I think the good thing with developers is if you give them an interesting problem to work on, mm-hmm. and I've done this myself, right?
Yeah.
You'll work the whole night. And it's not because someone's forcing you to do it.
Yeah.
It's just because your mind is sort of saying, I got to solve this.
Right? Yeah.
So they're demanding work-life balance. And maybe as leaders, we should accommodate that need. In spite of that, I think a lot of people are going to work really hard.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right, which is, I always ask myself whether I'm biased because we've started HackerRank and we're in the developer space, that there is everything around me. Like when I go to the San Jose airport, everything around me is AWS. Is it because I'm noticing these billboards because I'm part of HackerRank? These have been there for 10 years, or is it because there's a sudden change in the whole developer landscape? And probably this is a change that's happening because every company is becoming a software company. It doesn't matter whether you're retail, financial services, automobile, you're all at the core of it. You're all building software to it. And how do you think about if that's going to be the world, which means originally it was Google, Facebook, Amazon competing. Now you're competing with probably everybody out there, every single industry.
That's right.
How do you think about attracting developers, and what are some of the things that, in terms of a talent brand, you know, I almost think whenever I go and visit a lot of customers, they have a generic talent brand, and then they have a separate thing for, here's how we're going to attract developers specifically.
Right.
And if you were to sort of, you had infinite resources, money, and all of those things, what are some of the things that you would do in terms of a talent brand or a developer brand to attract more developers to your company?
Yes. I think we touched upon many of these in our conversation so far. Developers like to solve problems, mm-hmm. right? That's why they get into the field.
Yeah.
They like to learn as they solve those problems. They like to learn new technologies, new ways of solving problems, new techniques.
Yeah.
So I would say if you can offer them those are the raw materials, they'll be happy, right? In addition, they like a culture that is developer friendly. Now we can talk about what that means.
Yeah, I love.
I'd say some work-life balance, open environment, open communication, mentors who they can turn to for help, a culture where there's collaboration,
mm-hmm.
and it's not like, okay, that guy you cannot talk to because he's really hard to communicate with. Mm-hmm. He's senior, but he's hard to communicate with. You want to get rid of that kind of thing, and you want to have a culture where, you know, it's open communication, collaboration, learning, and you learn from each other, right? Mm-hmm. And you have hard problems to solve, and, you know, you feed them well and give them food and drink unlimited. And I think
that Google drove, or was it true before that?
It was not true before.
Yeah, I see. So yeah. Google was the driver for
I
the
think
free
Google
food
changed
thing.
It, yeah.
Interesting. And do you think people are doing enough in this whole talent brand to advertise themselves as developer-friendly? Because it just get diluted if you're just going to have a generic brand across all of the different organizations that you're going to hire versus developer focused. Do you see companies doing developer brand specifically?
I see that a lot of times you'll see that in the form of a developer blog, and the good ones will actually talk about very meaningful things that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, developers actually like this new generation of developers mm-hmm. since the open source world has started. And this is a very good thing. A lot of my team members have said, you know, we don't want to just be consuming. We want to actually give back.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the company can actually create like one or more open source projects where they're contributing back and are allowing their developers to do that,
mm-hmm.
they love to do that. And I think that also becomes an important thing, like Facebook with React, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're giving back, and a lot of people end up, you know, wanting to work on that technology. So I think companies who are contributing to open source, who are, you know, creating a developer blog and publishing information about what they're doing inside, sort of sharing with the world. Spotify has some really nice videos about the way they organize process for developers. All of those things attract developers, right? So a few companies are doing it well. A lot of them are not, right?
Okay.
And I think they're not maybe aware of how important that is.
There is this common theme, at least in Silicon Valley, that's going around that hey, there is a lot of, there's a talent shortage.
That's right.
What are some of the ways that you think we can solve? And what are some of the non-traditional ways that you have taken in your career to hire developers?
Mm-hmm. So I do agree. There is a talent shortage. It, you know, takes a lot of effort to fill positions. Mm-hmm. And it's become even more common now that people have multiple offers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though you like the person and they like you, they may have three other things they like. Mm-hmm. And so you're always competing to close, right? And a lot of times you don't close. It is a big problem. Some non-traditional approaches that I've used, one is I'll look at other locations. Fortunately, at HackerRank, we already have a great presence in Bangalore. Typically, I'll look at other cities where there are universities mm-hmm. and educational institutions where people are being trained. Or I also look for clusters where there are other companies. For example, I think North Carolina, where IBM has a big presence, mm-hmm. has a lot of people there who, you know, you can potentially attract. Mm. If you set up as a startup, you set up a company there, I'm sure the IBM colleagues there will not like what I'm saying. But
who are the best two programmers that people should hire from IBM?
And by the way, this is a very positive thing. IBM has some amazing developers in IBM. There's lots of people there, but they're amazing people. So, you know, look for clusters where there are companies where, you know, they may have people who might be willing to move mm-hmm. and try out something new. Boot camps has been another trend that's been going on for maybe like the last 5-6 years. And I've hired from there. I've like interacted with them. I've helped boot camps. And, you know, I've got mixed results. I think for boot camps to become more sustainable and to become a true source of delivering talent, developer talent, they need to go deeper in the material and maybe even have the boot camps be longer term. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I think they just take, they're more like the online courses. They take a package thing like front end developer and they kind of try to cram it into like, you know, 2 or 3 months or something.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get the full depth that way, right? So I'd say that's another way to attract. Looking carefully across, people use LinkedIn, obviously, but using more locations where developers hang out, mm-hmm. like GitHub, mm-hmm. Stack Overflow, and any other security-oriented, you know, there's very niche communities across the web. HackerRank is also a good community to mm-hmm. look at. You'll find people who are interested in a certain topic. And so I've used that mechanism as well. We hired somebody for React through GitHub. I've also hired through meetups, mm-hmm. like where I went to an Android meetup and I hired somebody and trained the person and got an iOS developer out of it. Mm-hmm. So there's those kinds of very sort of niche techniques that you can use to go find people, you know, who might be passive and they're not actively looking, but you can pull them out of where they are. Vivek, what do you think about boot camps?
Like you mentioned, I think it's definitely a big source or a potential source of a new set of developers or talent that's mm-hmm. coming. It's definitely heading the right direction. But I agree with you that boot camps could take a longer term approach. And even when you look at the survey, boot camps was ranked lowest or in the bottom three or bottom four. And I think the reason is partly because of the way it is positioned or structured, which is you don't know anything about coding, come here in 3 months and you can learn how to code. And then get $100,000 salary. I mean, by default, that positioning seems odd when you think about as a VP of engineering or as a hiring manager. How can you do that? And I feel if people took a longer term, that is, this would be my dream boot camp if I were to structure one, which would be here are all the different disciplines of computer science, data science, security, front end, back end, mobile, and others. And just go ahead and build out a simple app or whatever for each of these different domains. Just go ahead and learn and see which one you're really attracted to. You might be really attracted to building an iOS app, or you might be really attracted to processing large amounts of data and deriving insights from it, which means you need to take different tracks or different courses. And when you don't have a traditional background in computer science, and you just say, you know what, come here and learn front-end developing, it's just hard. You might not even like it. That's how I would structure, which is the phase one is know what you're passionate about. And phase two is, okay, once you learn what you're passionate about, let's just go super deep and try to make you a master in that. I think the closest one that I've seen this is a school called 42. It's actually a French school, okay. And they've just started in sort of a branch or a division here in Fremont. I visited there. So you can just go in and they have a map of here are all the different skills. And you just choose one of them and you just continue to learn and you can go as deep as you want. And after you pass a particular level or a particular stage, and also the timing varies. Some people could do it in 3 months. Some people could do it in 9 months because the rate at which people learn are different. And then after you pass a particular level, they help you then connect with companies. It's not a finite time that you have to graduate or you have to pass. If your rate of learning is high, you know what? You could actually go and get connected to another company. But it's super deep learning on one particular aspect that you are passionate, that you like about, mm-hmm. which means your self-learning capabilities just grow. Again, I'm not sure how many companies have hired from 42 and others. It's growing pretty well. And HackerRank is also a partner with 42. But that's one thing that is closer to what I would think about an ideal bootcamp.
Mm-hmm. So your comments about the bootcamp are quite interesting. The school sounds very promising.
Yeah.
I think adaptive learning is a good way to go. But another thing to keep in mind is as we end up with a large number of non-traditional sources of developers, we're going to have to start thinking about how do we assess them. The traditional way of looking at a resume, I mean, like a resume of somebody from a bootcamp, it's not going to tell you very much, mm-hmm, right? Because mm-hmm. here we're discounting even university and stuff. We're just, is one bootcamp better than the other? Maybe, but it's still not enough, right?
Yeah.
So what you really, really need is for that person to be able to showcase what they can do, mm-hmm. right? Their skill.
Yeah.
Ideally, they can like have a portfolio of work that they can show you. But in the absence of that, some sort of automated way to assess that if they don't have that already would be a very good way for a hiring manager for an organization to go at scale and assess lots of these people and only bring in, kind of filter out all the people who are not a fit, right? And I believe HackerRank is trying to do both of those things, actually. Assessment is already a very well-known capability, mm-hmm. but your vision is to create developer profiles, right?
Yeah.
And let people showcase what they are capable of doing.
You know, our vision at HackerRank, why we started, and our mission is to match every developer to the right job, yes. with the underlying driver being skill. And I imagine a world in the future where every developer is getting hired, can showcase a skill purely based on skills, right. and not biased to, you know, which school did you go to, which company you worked at before, and sort of democratize recruiting and make it an even playing field. There are many more interesting insights for all of you. You could go to research.hackerrank to download the developer skills report for 2018. We plan to do this every year. Okay, we'll probably end with a quick rapid fire, and it should be straightforward. Vim or Emacs?
I like Emacs.
Tabs or spaces?
Tabs.
What's the language or framework that you're learning right now?
Scala.
Okay. Thank you so much for the listeners. If you have any specific questions or topics, tweet to @HackerRank. And I will see you in episode 3.